Welcome to JS on Politics, our weekly look at what's happening in Wisconsin, and this week in particular, what's happening with Governor Scott Walker. Here's a quick look at what's ahead on today's show. This morning's Supreme Court ruling ends the long-running John Doe investigation into campaign-related matters for Scott Walker. The Senate yesterday passed a deal for the Bucks Arena, so we'll talk about how that came together and what pressure that puts on the Assembly. We'll look at Scott Walker's presidential announcement from Monday and his first week on the campaign trail as an official candidate. We'll also take some viewer questions, some of which just may be about Scott Walker. So send those questions in. And we're going to start with Jason Stein in Madison to get us the latest on the ruling from the Supreme Court today on the John Doe investigation, which effectively shuts it down in very strong language. Jason, talk a little bit about what the court said this morning and what the significance of that is.
Sure. Well, this is a long-running investigation. This John Doe and its predecessor have been going for years. The Wisconsin Supreme Court shut that investigation down today. Very strong language. Saying that the targets of the investigation had done nothing wrong and were being, having their constitutional rights improperly violated.
Yeah, well, you described them as brave, I think, and went on to say, some of the language I took out of it was, the utterly clear the prosecutor has employed theories of law that do not exist in order to investigate wholly innocent citizens. I mean, this, of course, the ruling probably wasn't unexpected given the makeup of the court, but spinning this ahead a little bit, does this give, those who were under investigation some fodder in these civil lawsuits and things that they're planning to pursue?
There's a ton of implications from it. I mean, the decision itself was expected. It wasn't unexpected, but that doesn't mean it's unimportant. It's going to have a lot of impacts. It could certainly affect some of the ongoing litigation that targets of the probe do have in state court. It could also affect legislation that's pending in the Wisconsin legislature. So, there was a lot of criticism by conservatives of the actions of the prosecutors in the case, both in using the John Doe procedure. It's a type of investigative tool to pursue these potential political charges that are now not going to result, and as well, particularly, there's been a lot of criticism of the fact that under the John Doe, you can investigate a target while putting a gag order on him or her, preventing them from speaking out about the investigation, and that's something that you'll certainly see the legislature consider changing in the coming.
Do you see any some of the political victory for Scott Walker going forward? But do you see any downsides for John Chisholm or any blowback there? Here's someone who's pursued this, and you get this language talking about it being an unconstitutional approach, and there was nothing there that could have been broken in the first place.
Sure, of course. I mean, of course, there's an impact to him. There's an impact to to John Chisholm, the Democratic Milwaukee County District Attorney. There's also a potential impact for Fran Schmitz, the former federal prosecutor who is the special prosecutor in this case, who has described himself as a Republican.
All right, let me throw in one question we got from a reader on this topic. This is from Bill, who says, now that the court has ruled on John Doe, what line of attacks will opponents in the GOP presidential primary try to use against Governor Walker? Do you see, for the governor, it certainly can be a talking point of, I've been investigated and it's all been clear, but do you see this playing out now? Is it something, how do you see it coming up in the presidential discussions?
I never really saw the John Doe investigation as something that would be very front and center in the presidential race. If you look back to Governor Walker's recent re-election campaign in 2014, again, that was not the major tool to use against him. It was more focused on the attacks were more focused on the economy. And I think that was what you were always going to see in the presidential race. Obviously, there'll always be some criticism from opponents in terms of this decision and the investigation. You see some liberal groups today talking about the fact that there had been spending on behalf of the justices who killed the investigation by groups that were implicated in the investigation. So, it's not like it's not going to be talked about. It is being talked about. But I don't think it was ever going to be the front and center critique.
We're going to bring in and shift topics here to the Bucks Arena deal that a week ago we were talking about. It's out of the budget. Does that mean it's on its, in dire straits? And we have Dan Beiser, Watchdog columnist, joining us to comment on this. But Jason, first, just give us the quickest rundown here. That would pass 21-10. You had Democratic support. You had a pretty strong Republican support. What's next as this goes toward the Assembly?
Sure. Well, the Arena plan definitely picked up momentum yesterday as it heads out of the Senate and into the Assembly. Arguably the Senate was a tougher vote, but certainly, even if you don't believe that, the proposal has a lot of momentum heading into the Assembly. Very unlikely that you're going to see it fail now. Again, it's $250 million, $250 million in public financing, plus additional interest costs to cover half the cost of a proposed new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks and to keep it.
Some things to make note of. One, the 21 votes was much higher than people had expected. We'd been counting votes saying that they needed three or four Democrats, and then they end up getting many more people than they expected. On the Assembly side, Robin Voss has said he needs at least 15 Democrats to vote for this. First of all, most people don't believe that number. They think the number is
higher or lower.
That's a little artificially high, because he wants to provide cover for some of his Republicans who might come under attack for this.
So any Democrat he gets beyond that, he can tell a Republican,
right,
we don't have to
each
take
time
this
he
vote.
Can. But it would mean, if he needs 15, that would mean almost half his caucus is going to oppose the Bucks deal. But, the Democratic Party yesterday gave some cover to their members by putting out a statement endorsing the legislation. And so the Democratic Party now is on record. But there are two concerns going forward. So the expectation is that it's going to pass the Assembly. There will be the votes, and there will be bipartisan in its support. But there are two issues going forward. One, there was a major change in terms of what was going on with Milwaukee County. They now will have to come up with $4 million a year somehow to pay for this. They were going to get it through this debt collection program with the state, but that's been removed. And so Chris Abley, the Milwaukee County executive, has to figure out what to do about that. Will he, will they make cuts? Will they do some sort of debt collection themselves? Or will they come back to the legislature and ask for this authority to do this contracting with the state again? And then the second issue, which Senator Fitzgerald mentioned today, and that is, mentioned yesterday, and that is, will these outstate legislators who voted for this come under attack in 2016 for this vote? It's something that everybody has to watch.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit. So, Jason, that was one of the breakthrough points on this, was they shifted this deal with the certification of debt. Was that just some political maneuvering to give the Democrats in Madison some cover? Because as I understand it, the executive can go assign this to the state anyways.
That's partially true. The Milwaukee County executive does have some debts assigned in Milwaukee County that he can hand over to the state. But no, there was actually a substantive change to this, and that's why you saw the county executive Abley get so angry about it. In fact, most of the debt that the county is owed is controlled by the county treasurer and the clerk of courts. And so Dave Cullen, the treasurer, and John Barrett, the clerk of courts, will have to decide whether or not they want to, work with Abley in handing over most of their debts to state government. I mean, what both men have told me so far is that they're open to the idea, but they do have reservations right now. So we're going to have to see how that works out.
But there is a political angle to it. What happened was it wasn't Madison Democrats seeking cover. It's Milwaukee Democrats who didn't want to be accused of paying for the arena on the backs of poor people who owed debts to the city and to the county. And so they didn't want to be the one saying that Milwaukee County had to do this, that this had to be the mechanism they used. They gave the option to Chris Abele. So they shifted the
So the blame will go to Abele
instead
more so
of
than,
to instead right. of to Lena Taylor and Chris Larson, the two who were pushing this the most.
Well, one area we haven't talked much about is the Common Council. The city of Milwaukee has some have to do some approving of parts of this as well. Do you see any problems there?
I don't think so. I mean, the city seems very happy. The funny thing is, throughout the negotiations, Chris Abele got a lot of praise and people were very supportive, and he stayed behind the scenes and didn't say much. And meanwhile, there was a great deal of criticism of Tom Barrett and how he wasn't taking a lead on this. But in the end, as it stands now, Tom Barrett ended up getting almost everything he wanted, including some authority to pursue some foreclosures and mortgages and other things like that. And Chris Abele is the one squawking and upset with how the deal turned out.
All right, well, we'll leave it there on the arena and go right now to look back a little bit at Scott Walker's announcement on Monday with this tape segment. So let's break it down into two things. There's sort of the content of the speech, you know, the words and the material, and then his delivery. So let's start with the content. What struck you about the content of that speech?
Well, a lot of familiar themes that we've been hearing, if you've been hearing him speak all along. I mean, one of the interesting things was what wasn't in the speech. I mean, there was no mention of immigration, which is an issue that's tripped him up, and he's been admittedly changed his position on. He tread very lightly on social issues. There were some glancing references to abortion and no mention of the same-sex marriage issue, and I think that's an indication of the fact that he doesn't want those kinds of issues to be his defining issues in his bid for the presidency.
What struck you, Dan?
One, the heavy emphasis on foreign policy. The last third of his speech was on foreign policy, something, an area where he's, you know, lacks the experience that some of his opponents do, and at the same time that it did not have those red meat issues, it was still a very strong, sort of bold speech. It's not hiding anything. He's a polarizing figure who has a polarizing agenda, and that's what he's offering in this election.
He used the word fight, I think, 14 times, and he used the word win or a variation of that 10 times. So that was the single takeaway I think he wanted for people was, and really been the theme of his campaign, I'm a fighter, I'm a winner. Republican voters, you don't have to choose between fighting and winning. You can have it both.
And you know, I think you got the real Scott Walker there. That was, I mean, he's very friendly, affable, a little confident, and also a little sweaty because it's very hot there. But at the same time, it is a message that's going to divide people. And so that's what he's been as governor. He is a friendly, affable, accessible guy. At the same time, he's beloved and hated in Wisconsin because of that
message.
Let's
talk a little bit about the delivery, because he was out there without a tie, without a sport coat, or without a podium even.
Or a teleprompter.
Was he trying to get across, or how did it come across?
I don't know if I've ever seen a major speech like that where the speaker distributed a written text, but then didn't either read from it or use a teleprompter. So he was basically delivering the speech off the cuff as he normally does, but he also had to stick to the sentence by sentence structure of this written speech. It's really, really hard to do that, and I actually think he did amazingly well when you consider how hard that is to do, but I think he does better when he's not trying to stick to a written text. And so I think to the degree that the speech was a little tentative, the delivery was a little tentative at times, it was because he was trying to stick to the structure of a prepared text, even though he wasn't reading from it.
Here in Wisconsin, the last time we heard him speak in a dramatic or focus on it was after his victory last fall. Has he improved a lot since then? I mean, just the delivery?
It was still impressive at the same time to do that. And, you know, you said keep to the text. He was like 80 to 90% of the time on the text. And you could tell when he thought he hit a line. He did this sort of, it was a new thing. I haven't seen him do this, where he nods his head like, yeah, I nailed that line. And when people were applauding, it used to be the smirk. He used to come out and he would smirk when he thought he did pretty well. He's grown a great deal as a speaker over the last 5 years. He used to think in terms of concepts, I think, and would leap from concept to concept. But this was clearly a speech that he knew sentence by sentence. And a couple of times he forgot a line, remembered it, and went back. So this has been something he's been working on for.
I think just one other point. I think he's got a lot left to prove about his capacity as a presidential candidate. But one thing that he has shown already, starting in Iowa 6 months ago, is that he can give a speech that energizes and animates and excites a Republican crowd. Well,
the advantage is the floor is, I mean, the expectations are not great. Everyone thinks he's bland, boring, Midwestern, whatever. So when he does pretty well in a speech, people respond fairly well to it.
See, this isn't, of course, going to be a one-time speech. He's going to use variations of this. Right. He already has on the stump. How do you think this plays with voters now in Nevada and South Carolina and New Hampshire and Iowa, where he's headed already this week?
Well, so one thing he's really trying to do and that really was striking about the program last night, not just the speech, but everything that preceded the speech, where there were testimonials and videos, was they're hitting the recall story so hard. And it's not just, as he told me on Sunday, about reminding people there was a recall, but it's about reminding people about the nature of the recall and how brutal it was and how intense it was, because he wants to tell the story of all the acute pressure that he and his family were under. He wants to talk about the death threats. The opposition in these videos and in these testimonials last night was painted as crazed and unhinged and out to get Scott Walker, and they think that resonates with the Republican voters.
But it doesn't. It's not a message for Wisconsin, clearly, because nearly half the people in Wisconsin opposed him, and a lot of people signed the recall petition. So, this recall, the opposition gets worse and worse each time they tell the story. You would think, that they were besieged daily.
How key, finally, as our last question, is this next stretch for him? So he's introduced himself again.
So if you look back at the last 6 months, he was catapulted by the speech in Iowa in January. Ton of publicity they weren't entirely prepared for, had some stumbles. And since then, he's come back down to earth. He's sort of in the middle of this big, giant cluster in the national polling. He was higher before. And so I think he does have an opportunity to get a bump out of this.
According to the tracking information, he's been to Iowa, South Carolina, and New Hampshire less often than any of the other 14 candidates running for president. So he's going to hit those places hard now. The budget's signed. He doesn't have a lot of obligations here. So he can take the message and go to those places frequently. And one thing we do see in Wisconsin is when he's out and he's visible, he tends to do much better in his polling numbers. So he's going to take this message. And some of this message, as you said, been around for a long time, this independence-dependence thing on government. He's been doing that message for about 4 years or so. So it's a message that he knows pretty well.
All right. Well, I think that's where we'll leave it for now. There'll be a lot more to chew over as this campaign goes forward. So thank you. All right. We're back live, and through the magic of the internet, Dan Bice has turned into James Causey, and Jason Stein has turned into Christian Schneider. I've changed my sport coat, but we're the same old crew here to move forward. We're going to talk a little bit about how Governor Scott Walker's done on the trail now this week. This is his first, post-announcement trip. He was in Nevada and South Carolina. We've heard some blowback from folks on comments related to the Boy Scouts and how the governor said he preferred the sort of the old protections that were with their policies on gay Boy Scout leaders. And then minimum wage is a lame idea. James, let's start. How is the governor doing out there?
Well, right now he sounds a little bit like the Scott Walker that we know and some people love. He stumbles a little bit, and then he comes back and tries to clean it all up. Like the situation with the Boy Scouts, a major stumble, I think. And this minimum wage was another major stumble. But to his base, he is still do well. But he has to do more to bring in people that don't look like him. People don't look like his crew that were supporting him.
Well, Christian, what's your general take on how the governor's done and just this is his first week in the sort of that extra heightened scrutiny.
Yeah, the thing with the Boy Scouts was almost kind of like Scott Walker when he first started being kind of a non-candidate, which was his answer was in two parts. It was what he initially said and then the clarification. So I think he's kind of backing off on that. But in both cases, these are things that are not necessarily going to lose him votes with GOP primary voters. I mean, he has a point with the minimum wage, saying that it's a lame idea. I mean, it's, Democrats say that they want to create jobs and increase incomes and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, that's an old idea that just keeps getting recycled over and over, and it's going to end up costing people jobs. So otherwise, I think he's done a pretty good job. I mean, he's been workmanlike. His speech at the Waukesha County Expo Center the other night was, you know, he hit all of his greatest hits. He did the Kohl's cash, which Jimmy Fallon kind of wrapped him for a little bit last night. But I thought it was a good speech. I thought the fact that he delivered it without any notes, without any teleprompter, I think was pretty impressive. So now he's just got to go try to convince people around the country that he's the guy that we know here.
Well, let's go back to these two things that stuck out, and not on either one individually as much as, I mean, it seems there's a propensity sometimes for the governor that he'll make his point in a way that will feed into the hands of his opponent. So he doesn't just say, you know, here's why the minimum wage is bad. He calls it a lame idea, which Hillary Clinton has probably already clipped and is ready for that TV ad should they be facing each other later on.
I mean, he's an expert at the soundbite. I mean, he does a very good job on throwing something out there, seeing how it plays, and then when it, depending on how it plays, if it goes bad for him, he comes back and corrects it. And you have to do more than sound bites now, but right now, if he just plays it straight and doesn't take any major risks, I think he'd be fine through the Iowa primaries and he won't have any worries. But, I mean, I don't know how he handles the pressure when a camera is in his face all the time. He doesn't seem like he seems a bit abrasive to me. And I don't think that plays well when you look at all the candidates in the hall.
Christian, do you think, is this a time for the governor to sort of be cautious and move forward that way, or is this a case with the wide open field that he has to you know, sort of be the Scott Walker we know with some of these bolder statements and things?
Yeah, I do think he needs to do some things to set himself apart. There are things that he's done that I don't agree with, when he called for a constitutional amendment against gay marriage. I just thought, you know, if you're going to set yourself apart from the field, why not do it in the direction that the country is actually headed? But with regard to the minimum wage, I mean, you have to remember in 2014 that was a major platform of the Democratic Party, and they just they got whitewashed all over the country. So I don't know that there's that you know, that much importance to the minimum wage issue. You know, I don't think it's going to hurt them all that much.
All right, let me talk briefly about each of you. I've had columns out recently, and James has one coming out today. Yours, Christian, was about, you know, Scott Walker is not really a divisive figure, which a lot of folks would go, really? But give us your spin on that. Why is he not as divisive as a lot of people think or as he's often portrayed?
Well, it seems like when we call somebody divisive, it's almost always either conservative or Republican for actually fighting for the things that they've actually said that they're going to fight for. And in his case, he has a Republican legislature, so he's able to do a lot of the things that he said he was going to do. You know, Democrats stand for a lot of things that are also divisive. I mean, you've seen the abortion issue kind of blow up this week. And there's a reason that the pro-choice movement uses words like pro-choice, because when you get into the details, it starts turning pretty divisive. It turns into pretty gruesome business. So my main point was that he is going to be labeled as divisive when the things that he's fought for aren't particularly divisive across the country. I mean, the federal government doesn't have the same type of collective bargaining rights that Wisconsin now does or had. And nobody calls Barack Obama divisive. I mean, Barack Obama took over 16% of the country's economy with Obamacare on a procedural vote that was kind of a gimmick. So I would think that would be pretty divisive. So
right. Let's have James talk a little bit about his piece, and then we're going to spin back a little bit to the Doe and take our reader questions. But your piece is about the American dream.
Yeah, I mean, I take a look at his speech, and when you listen to Walker talk about it, he basically says if you work hard and don't break the rules, then you can achieve this American dream. And I said, well, you know, that sounds good. It's a great soundbite, but in reality, that's not true for a lot of people that I know. And so I break that down and I talk about how different Scott Walker's dream of the American dream is a lot different than mine and a lot different than a lot of people that I write about and talk to.
Okay, we're in our few minutes we have left. Let's circle back a bit to the John Doe ruling this morning, because that's such a significant ruling, even if it was expected, as Jason described it earlier. You know, Christian, how do you see this playing out going forward? I mean, just what's your take on this ruling and what its significance is?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly going to have an effect on campaigns going forward. What the court essentially said was that you can actually engage in political speech without worrying about the long arm of the law coming and showing up at your house and, you know, raiding your home in a pre-dawn armed raid. So basically what, you know, Chisholm and the prosecution has done all along is apply laws that have long since not expired, but have been struck down by decades of Supreme Court rulings. And I just think it really looks bad for him. And it's definitely going to affect campaigns in the future, I think.
All right. Let's turn to some of our viewer questions now. The first one we're going to go to James with, who says, this is from No to the Arena. So the question is, what can we do to get this thing stopped in the assembly? We're just giving money to billionaires when we have kids dying in the streets. So first, I know you're a supporter of the arena, and you're an anti-kids dying in the streets.
Yeah.
So is this thing going to be stopped? And if not, how do we address these other issues?
Well, I think the most difficult hurdle has been passed already. I don't think it's going to be stopped. And the two things are so unrelated. The arena compared to kids dying in the street. I mean, I wish it was that simple. I wish we could say, don't build an arena and all the kids will stop dying on the street.
Right, because
we could
take that money and put it here, but that's not how the
system works. It's not just about the money, too. I mean, that's where people get this all mixed up. And when it comes to the number of people being shot and killed, it's not checkers, it's chess. It's more complicated, it's more strategic. We have to look at racism. We have to look at how we don't make the investment in these communities, how a lot of these communities don't have livable wage jobs, transportation is the issue, all these barriers that need to be addressed. What we have to do is start taking it issue by issue, point by point, in order to get
right,
some.
Let's go to this one from, this is for Christian, from a reader, the handle is Joswick, and it says, Walker continues to portray himself as a Washington outsider. The only outside thing about him is that he hasn't lived in D.C. As a lifelong politician, never having any job since his departure from Marquette, he is more of a political insider than many Washington politicians. Just respond to that. Is that something that's a concern for Walker as he portrays himself this way? But he's also running against a lot of political insiders. That's what you are by the time you run for president, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, this is a talking point that just drives me crazy. I mean, the people on the left say, Scott Walker is a lifelong political operative or career politician. When you've got guys like Russ Feingold, for instance, and Tammy Baldwin, and people who, you know, have scarcely had a job outside of politics throughout their entire lives. So, I mean, it's a talking point that they want to use against him, but it's always one that you use, you know, against somebody that's in a party that you don't agree with.
All right, we're going to throw this one to James. This is from Frustrated. He says, now that the John Doe has been declared a farce, when will John Chisholm get run out of town? If no one takes him on in the election, how can he be booted from office?
Well,
how do you think he's sort of being portrayed, or how does he come off in all this now that it's sort of pretty well settled?
Now that it's settled, I wish he would become more visible. And visible in a different way than he has been portrayed. The boot him out, DAs, they don't really get booted out like that.
Often don't get challenged.
Yeah, and who's going to challenge him? I would like to hear anybody step up and issue a challenge to him. I mean, this is the perfect opportunity to do it, but I don't see anybody stepping up to challenge him, and if they do, he'll win anyway.
Right. What do you think on the visibility question? Where would you like to see him more visible? Obviously crime-related, but we don't.
That's,
when's the last time we saw a news conference or a statement from him?
Exactly.
About what's
that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, with all the issue with we're on a record pace for homicides, I'd like to hear him say something. I'd like to hear him also talk about how we give a lot of people a slap on the hand and let them go out again and commit further crimes. I know this whole thing that we say that we have this mass incarceration problem, but at the same time, we have a lot of people on the street who should not be on the street. And he needs to answer to a lot of these people.
All right, that's all we have time for today, so we thank all of our viewers for joining us, and we'll be back same time next week, and I don't know who will be sitting where, but we'll sort that out.
We'll figure it out.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.